You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we are joined in studio once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon. How's your morning been going?
It's been going well, thank you.
That's good to hear. What have we got? We've got lots of stuff going on in science here. Very interesting show. A few dead animals. Classic scientific stuff. What have we got about this antibiotic here? What's going on there?
So this is an antibiotic called bacitracin, and it's about 70 years old. And what's kind of interesting about this study was it was performed in the Netherlands, but the Netherlands don't actually really use this antibiotic anymore. It's more used in North America and other parts of the world. And it's commonly found as a topical application. So if you think of skinning your knee and you put a cream on it when it gets a bit infected, it might have this bacitracin antibiotic in it. And so what a lot of antibiotics, they kind of start their life as a product from a soil-dwelling microorganism. So they're not, the molecules aren't really engineered or, you know, aren't optimal for treating in the human body, but we kind of recognize they have these antibiotic properties, and then chemists will come in and they'll start fiddling with the structures of them and making them a bit better and basically improving them for us to use in human health and animal health. And this has happened a lot with penicillins. So if we think antibiotics, most of us are going to start thinking of the penicillins
first. Yeah, classic example. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so what's kind of interesting about this bacitracin is it hasn't really been touched. Like, we've kind of just been using it as it was initially found. Like, yes, we make it synthetically now, but no one's really tried to improve the structure. And what this chemist has done with his group is basically they looked at the structure of the bacitracin and how its mechanism of action, and they were like, oh, we think we could improve this. Should we give it a go? And basically what happens with this specific type of antibiotic is that how it stops bacteria growing is it attaches to the cell membrane, and then it basically grips on and it doesn't let the cell make a cell wall. And so this stops growth. And so then the bacteria aren't replicating. And so you don't get that infection. You don't have that problem.
Right.
So that's
right.
How it works like an antibiotic. Now, when it attaches to that cell membrane, it basically has 5 points of contact. So it's kind of, you know, gripping on.
Yeah,
and
right.
Yeah. And so what this medicinal chemist thought was, well, how can we make those five arms, how it grips, how can we make them longer and stickier so that it really...
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Holds on and it's not letting go. And then, so basically to improve how well it's working. And so that's basically what they did. They just started changing those 5 points of contact in the lab. They made about 20 different compounds, and then they just tested them to see how good they were as an antibiotic.
Right, and those would be like variations on arm length, that sort of thing?
Yeah, variations on the theme. Yeah. So basically those five different arms, they would change this sort of, like, this is actually what's called a polypeptide. So it's like a tiny protein kind of thing. It uses amino acids, and so they were just changing those up, changing the chemistry so that, yeah, making it a bit longer, making it a bit stickier so it bonds on stronger.
Got it.
And what they found, actually, with their analogs that they made, these 20 different types of, these 20 different variations, is actually they were like 10 to 100 times more potent.
Oh, wow. That's quite significant. Yeah.
Right. That's nothing to sneeze at.
Mm.
And so they were, you know, like, this is great. Like, they've shown it, that this kind of idea works for this type of antibiotic. But what was even, in my opinion, even more exciting was that a couple of these variants, they did also test against antibiotic-resistant isolates. So these are bacteria that have probably been sampled from someone's infection or something, and they've isolated them, and they know they're antibacterial resistant.
Right.
So in
this
case, they were resistant to a commonly used antibiotic called vancomycin.
Got it.
And so this is a big concern in health. Mm. Like, how do we treat these things? What is in our arsenal to kill these infections? And two of these compounds that they made were actually effective against these vancomycin-resistant isolates that they had. So not only did they increase the potency of the antibiotic against just the bulk standard bad bacteria that they were kind of testing on, but, you know, with these ones that have kind of supercharged to be resistant, it showed promise. So
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, sorry.
Almost taking, like, you've got these supercharged bacteria. We're taking this, like, supercharged antibiotic and bringing that in.
And it is like that, right? Yeah. Like, we, the human health and the, we're kind of in a bit of an arms race with bacteria in trying to, you know, beat out the resistance they develop very quickly. And that's, yeah, exactly what it is. And so they'd done this work in the lab and they just wanted to show it was plausible. So they haven't really considered, is this an economically viable? Could we make this? How would this work in people and all that? So there's still like a bunch of work to do, but it was kind of going, yeah, if we just target these 5 points on this molecule, it gets better. And so, yeah, it's kind of showing that, you know, we shouldn't discount things just because they're a bit old and we've been using them for a while. We should, you know, always go back and look.
Is that something that happens like often where we look at old stuff and try to figure out how it can be like made new?
Yeah, no, there is a lot of work where, you look back and you go, okay, you know, lots of the methods we have. Like, so one of the reasons that this chemist was able to go, oh, I think this might work, was because there was crystal structures recently published, you know, in the last few years that showed how this molecule was binding into the cell membrane and stuff, which hadn't been available beforehand.
Right.
And so,
yeah,
you can start to recognize mechanism of action, you better understand. And so, yeah, you kind of look back and you go, oh, maybe we should try this.
Mm. Like new discoveries sort of informing how we can better use the old.
Yeah, that's really exactly.
Yeah, and then what have we got here about, I've written in here, popsicled woolly mammoth DNA. What's going on there?
That's a perfect description for this. This is really cool. So in 2018, so a few years ago now, in the permafrost of Siberia, they found this piece of skin that was from the head of a woolly mammoth. So it still had hair attached and it actually had an intact ear.
Mm.
So it was like, you can go online and look at the pictures and you wouldn't think it was 52,000 years old.
Wow.
Like, it's incredibly preserved. So being 52,000 years old, that means it's in a comes from a period of time called the late Pleistocene. So old. And this mammoth, when it died and it basically froze in such a way that you had this, not just this awesome preservation where you could look at it and go, yeah, this is a skin, this is an ear, this is hair, but actually the three-dimensional structure of the genetic code is preserved. And this is the first time this has been observed.
Wow.
This is amazing.
Yeah. So on a really deep level, we've got...
nanometer
Jurassic
level.
Jurassic Park type stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly what I, you know, when I was reading this article, I was thinking of, you know, like the start of the very first movie with the amber and the... So it's kind of... It's pretty awesome. Ancient DNA isn't really new to science, this concept. So through reading this story, I learned this. I hadn't known this before, but like in the 1980s, DNA from what are called quagga. So if no one's ever heard of a quagga before.
No, I'm not familiar.
So it's a type of zebra that's now extinct.
Right.
They are kind of most commonly associated with South Africa, but they probably lived kind of sub-Saharan Africa kind of area. And they're quite cool in that they're brown and white striped, but only on the front half. The back half looks kind of like a horse. So you kind of, it's like a half zebra, half horse.
Yeah, a bit of a weird mishmash sort of animal.
Exactly, right. And so there are, you know, they didn't go extinct that long ago in terms of time. And so there are actually like skins and stuff you can see in South African museums and stuff. So not super, super old, this example, but, you know, like they were able to sequence DNA from an animal that was 150 years dead. So this was kind of the first time they were like, oh, we might, DNA actually lasts a wee while.
Yeah.
We might be able to, you know, sequence. They've actually managed to sequence DNA from mammoth teeth that's over 1 million years old.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's seriously.
That's quite a bit more than 52,000. Jeez.
But here's the kicker. So what happens when you, with this ancient, these previous ancient DNA studies and what they've been sequencing is just fragments. So the DNA is there, but it's broken down. So you've just got little pieces.
Right.
So you can kind of think like you've only got like 100 letters of the DNA code. And so it's interesting. We learn lots, but we're not getting a whole genome. Like we're not getting the blueprint to, you know, make that animal again sort of thing.
Yeah, no Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Thus far.
Yeah, no. And so it's kind of, you can think of it like, say you were given all the pages to a book, you've got no page numbers, but you're told, here, put the book back together.
Mm, right.
It's, what order?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, you could give it a shot, but
yeah, yeah, you can give it a shot, and you know, like,
you
and
know, there's with a funky looking mammoth, yeah,
exactly. And so, what's really, really cool about this skin and this specimen that they found is actually that because of the preservation, it has actually saved kind of the whole book. It's preserved the whole book. Like, you've got the three dimensional structure of the genetic code, which is the chromosome, is preserved. So, for the chromosomes, it's probably a term we are reasonably familiar, but it's basically the packages of DNA in our cells.
Yep.
And the way that DNA is arranged in these chromosomes tells us actually a lot about which genes are active and not active in the cell function. Mm-hmm. So finding this, like, this preservation and having this, you know, three-dimensional structure to the DNA in there is just wickedly informative.
Yeah. So we might be, you know, Jurassic Park in the past, maybe not so doable now.
Yeah, so the lead author was very definite in pointing out that they didn't go into this to get the genetic code to re-engineer or, you know.
Right, okay.
So the term that there is actually a field of study called de-extinction, which is about doing the, like, the Jurassic Park type thing, bringing animals back. And the woolly mammoth is probably one of the animals that's had the most work done on it because you do get a lot of preservation of tissue and stuff because they lived in very cold environments.
Yeah, that makes
stuff.
Sense.
Yeah, and so there is that work, and so this is like a big step forward for that, but this wasn't, you know, the authors or the scientists studying this wasn't their drive.
Got it.
They were more interested in the tissue and the genetics from just an understanding point of view, but it could inform. Yeah.
Right. And then jumping forward 50,000 years in terms of dead animals, what have we got here with this crocodile in Egypt?
So this crocodile has the really cool name of 2005.335.
Oh, classic. Just rolls off the tongue.
So this is what's called an accession number. So this crocodile is held in the Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery. And it's about 2,000 to 3,000 years old. It's a mummified crocodile. And so that period of 2,000 to 3,000 years ago was when mummifying animals in ancient Egypt was at its peak.
Right.
And what they've, like, we all... Oh, I know as a kid, and I'm still quite fascinated by mummification and stuff.
Classic stuff.
Exactly, right? You think museums, you think mummies and stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And so what they've done is they've actually CT scanned it. So computed tomography, it's basically x-rays, but it's giving you the three-dimensional structure because you take lots of angles and pictures and stuff. And so they've been able to do a three-dimensional digital reconstruction of this crocodile, and they're kind of just doing it because it was a cool thing to do. It was, you know, the public's interested. But what they found is they think they figured out how it died.
Oh, wow. So that's big. Autopsy 2,000 years later.
Right, and it's really interesting. And so if you look at this this CT data, what you discover is that there's actually a fish in the stomach of this crocodile and a big hook.
Oh, not so great.
And this is, so they know, well, you can kind of deduct that this crocodile must have died not too long before it swallowed this fish and this hook because the fish skeleton is pretty intact, and so that means the
digestion. Right.
Exactly, right. The other thing that crocodiles do, because they swallow animals whole, they will swallow small stones called gastroliths. Well, we end up calling them gastroliths once they're swallowed. And it's basically, it helps digestion, you know, like it's stones in the stomach to kind of
got beat. It.
And so this crocodile also has these gastroliths in its upper digestive tract. So they haven't got to doing the work and smashing up this fish yet.
Right.
And so because this fish and these gastroliths are where they are and the fish is quite intact, they're like, okay, well, this crocodile must have died pretty quickly.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so they think, it's probably the hook kind of put an end to the crocodile.
Wow.
But then from this, what, you know, this is where it's where this sort of field of study is really cool, in that it's not just the science, it's also about the society and the humanities of it and stuff.
Yeah.
Where you go, okay, well, maybe this crocodile was actually caught on purpose. You know, so they've used the fish as kind of a bait.
Oh, and yeah.
And so they've caught it on purpose for the specific purpose of mummifying it as a, perhaps as an offering to the crocodile god Sobek, who was in ancient Egyptian culture. Also, it turned out the ancient Egyptians also, healthy crocodiles were associated with fertility and plentiful agriculture. And so maybe they were
it's looking good for the crocodile. Well, not so good, but...
It was preserved for all time kind of thing. Like, it's lasted quite well.
That's incredible. The whole autopsy process... I mean, I was hooked on how that went. That was incredible. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Kushla, for coming in today. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.